Welcome to the Tell Us Something podcast. I'm Mark Moss, founder and executive director of Tell Us Something. We are currently looking for storytellers for the next Tell Us Something storytelling event. The theme is Hold My Beer. If you'd like to pitch a story for consideration, please call 406-203-4683. You have 3 minutes to leave your pitch. The pitch deadline is December 7th. I look forward to hearing from you. This week on the podcast,
someday you're gonna be cool. That is what the rebellious older sister says to her younger brother towards the beginning of Almost Famous. My rebellious younger sister did not share that same positive outlook.
A couple weeks later, Mom got me into private speech therapy in order to improve some of my speaking, reading, and writing. And Mom was also told that I was not going to be able to read or write in my life when she first found out I had autism.
Four storytellers shared their true personal story on the theme, Never Again.
And it's a party. Everyone's dancing. Everyone's singing along. Strangers are kissing each other, hugging. Everyone's just, hey, it's a celebration.
I realized that I was in the middle of this horrific storm, suspended from a few sheets of ripstop nylon. It's funny how there's not fear, how logic kicks in when you're making decisions that may possibly save your life.
Their stories were recorded live in person in front of a packed house September 18th, 2024 at the George and Jane Dennison Theater in Missoula, Montana. Tell Us Something acknowledges that we gather on the ancestral lands of the Salish, Kootenai, and Pendele peoples. These lands have been inhabited for millennia, shaped by the wisdom and stewardship of the First Nation peoples. We acknowledge the historical and ongoing trauma inflicted upon Indigenous communities, including the forcible removal from their lands, the destruction of their cultures, and the systemic injustices that continue to persist. As we honor the Indigenous people who have called this place home, let us commit to learning from their traditions and values. A tangible way to do that, if you live in Missoula, Montana, is to visit the Missoula Public Library. On Friday, November 1st, Missoula Public Library hosts a First Friday event highlighting Native art and culture, showcasing the library's permanent collection. That event kicks off 4 weeks of programming celebrating Native American Heritage Month. A tool TV will be installed on the Harrison Children's Library. They will unveil an exhibit of the Salish Kootenai Seasonal Round that gives children a new interactive learning tool. They will also debut a new collection of Indigenous books and materials. Stop by the library or visit MissoulaPublicLibrary.org to learn more. Tell Us Something stories sometimes have adult themes. Storytellers sometimes use adult language. In our first story, listen to James Crosby share his disastrous sailing camp experiences and life-changing moments as a lifeguard. James shares his journey of self-discovery and resilience and discovers how a seemingly simple act of kindness led him to finding his true calling and inspire others along the way in a story that he calls Too Big to Sail. Thanks for listening.
Someday, you're gonna be cool. That is what the rebellious older sister says to her younger brother towards the beginning of Almost Famous. My rebellious younger sister did not share that same positive outlook. I had no shot at being cool. All the things you needed to do to be cool, I was not good at. You see, when I turned 13, I had gone through a growth spurt that was kind of like one of those Play-Doh pasta presses. My limbs just shot out of my body. And I was a total liability on the sports field. I was kind of like if the wacky inflatable arms guy had a jersey on. Nice defense, James. I'm on your team. Well, so I had yet to find my thing. I had yet to find the thing that would make me cool. But if I was signing your yearbook headed into the summer that I turned 13, I knew that my time was coming because I was looking forward to sailing camp. Sailing camp Last summer, this was when I was 12, I had gone for the first time. It was the Chesapeake Bay, and you couldn't have been further from the ocean. It was great because I had just started watching Shark Week, so sailing was not a great choice, but we overcame that because, my goodness, I got it. Portside. Port, P-O-R-T. That's left, L-E-F-T. Nice. Starboard. I like starburst. So I open them with my right hand. Starboard, starburst, right. Yes, I got it. I could tie some knots. Like, all right, that's pretty good. And when we finally got into the boats, I kind of understood how the wind worked. And boy, that feeling when you got going downwind and you tacked, so the wind caught the other side of the sail and the boom swung over your head and caught the wind and you felt the power of the boat surge forward, the sun on your face, the wind, the sound of the water on the hull of the boat, I was in it. And there was nobody else I could disappoint. It was just me out on my boat, the captain of my craft. It was great. The things that I had to endure with sailing camp also included golf. It hurts when you swing and whiff. It hurts even worse when you hear somebody behind you go, ooh. And then there was tennis. Tennis, I was the only camper to ever lose an entire game on the serve. I was serving up nothing but disappointment. I was so bad that after I lost this entire game, I went to practice my serve against the fence, and I just hit the ball straight over the fence, across the road, into the pool. Nobody wanted me on my team. Nobody wanted me on their team. I didn't want to be on my team, let's be honest. So finally, it came time to sail, and I was so excited. I was so excited. Except as a camper, I was there towards the end of the summer. So a lot of the other campers, they were there the whole summer. And this summer that I returned, I noticed that the people I had been sailing with last summer had moved on to bigger boats. Suddenly, the people around me were a lot smaller. And when I went to set up my boat that year, I noticed that the mast was kind of short. In fact, the whole gear was unusually easy to carry over. And when I finally set up my boat and shoved offshore out into the great wide open of the Chesapeake Bay, once again, this is far from the ocean. You could probably stand the whole time, but there I was out on my boat. And when I went to tack, to turn the boat, when the boom was supposed to go over my head, this time it hit me right in the arm. And I wrestled the boom over my head and pushed it out to the other side, at which point the boat had turned back into the wind and the boom came right back, knocked me into the back corner of my craft, and I took on some water. Yikes. All right, so I'm bailing it out and the boom's coming around and I try to push it around and I fall back and I take on some more water. And before I know it, I hear the thing that still chills me to my soul. It's the recovery boat coming out to say, hey, are you okay? If you have to say, are you okay? I am not okay. And as they dragged me back to shore, waist deep in water, because I couldn't fit on the recovery boat while they held the sail, the look from my peers was mortifying. I did fail upwards, though. I became somebody else's problem. I was too big to sail, so they put me in the bigger boats. That didn't make me a better sailor. Now I just had two other people in the boat with me. Luckily, they were also bad at sailing. So I wasn't really letting them down. We were all figuring it out. Well, at the end of the week, it came time for the Gibson Island Regatta, and we had accomplished nothing. In fact, our boat was so bad that by the time we thankfully crossed the finish line, the other boats were already de-rigging up on the beach. But there were only three boats in the race that day, so we got a medal. I still felt like a loser, but I was so bankrupt of mojo that when the cute girl at camp asked me to go to the dance, I said no. Because once again, the wacky, wavy, inflatable arms guy was not on the dance floor, I promise. So I vowed at that time I would never sail again. Until years later, I had become a lifeguard. Now, I became a lifeguard because I thought lifeguards were cool. And in a pool, I didn't really have to swim because I could stand just about everywhere. So I had become a lifeguard, and I took it very seriously. And my sister was also a lifeguard, and she could assure you that I was still not cool. And one day, I met a guy who would change everything. I saw this guy get up onto the diving board with his son and throw his son from the diving board into the water. And from across the pool, I was like, it's time, I gotta go. So I went cruising, sir, sir. And his son was flopping in the deep end, looked like he was drowning. And as I get closer, he pops his head out of the water. He's got this huge smile on his face and he's swimming. And I was like, oh my gosh, what's happening? And the guy on the diving board's laughing and he's laughing. He says, hey, it's okay. We do this all the time. This is my son, Josh. And Josh has cerebral palsy. He can't get around great on land. But when he's in the water, he can do his thing. And Josh is a daredevil. He doesn't want to get in through the shallow end. He wants to get chucked in to the deep end. So it turns out Ross says, hey, we're looking for lifeguards. Are you looking for some extra time, some extra help? And I said, yeah, I think that could be cool. And he says, actually, it's a windsurfing program. Do you know how to sail? Well, Ross, I got third place in the Gibson Island Regatta. So I show up for my first day on the job. Meet the other instructors. They're all really cool. We're all getting along. And this camp is for kids with disabilities. And the whole thing is to get them out on the water, to get them to move in ways that they can't on land. And my job as a windsurf instructor is to use this adaptive windsurfer. It's two long, skinny windsurfers with a sheet of 4-foot by 8-foot plywood in between. It has two sails. The front sail is for the instructor to work the sail, catch the wind, and move us around. The back sail, a much smaller one, is for our athletes. Kids in wheelchairs, kids that can't move around. Sometimes the only thing they can move is one finger. And my job is to get that one finger on the boom so that they can feel the wind catch the sail. They can feel the boat surge across the water. They can hear the water on the hull. And if the wind moves the wrong direction, I'm there to block the boom. That was something I was super qualified at. So whatever it took for me to get to that point was something I was happy to endure because the look on those kids' faces made it all worthwhile.
Thanks, James. The oldest and tallest among dozens of first cousins, James Crosby oddly and infuriatingly found himself outmatched in many backyard sports. He earned scores of nicknames, Stonehands, Butterfingers, Floodpants, all apt descriptions of his athletic prowess and giraffe-like physique. After years of searching for the thing that could make him cool, a summer job with Access Sport America taught him to be something better. To learn more about the adaptive programs at Access Sport America, visit goaccess.org. In our next story, Aaron Miller's autism diagnosis doesn't define him, it fuels his determination. From speech therapy to high school theater, Aaron overcomes his challenges and proves his capabilities. Aaron believes that disabilities aren't limitations, they're opportunities for growth. Aaron calls his story Growing Up. Thanks for listening.
Sorry, I was laughing too hard from James' story. So I have less of a story and a little bit more of a statement. So a lot of people think of mental disabilities, such as autism, ADHD, as bad. But I'm going to say they're not. And I'm not saying that because I have one of my own. I'm saying because it's true. And here's why. So when I was 4, Mom had just found out that I had autism. And she had absolutely no idea how to react. My brother was born 3 years before I was. And he does not have anything like autism or ADHD or even anything that he got later in life, like PTSD or anything like that. So Mom had no idea how to react. A couple weeks later, Mom got me into private speech therapy in order to improve some of my speaking, reading, and writing. And Mom was also told that I was not going to be able to be able, or, sorry, I was not going to be able to read or write in my life when she first found out I had autism. So a couple weeks later, she signs me up for private speech therapy in order to improve my speaking, reading, and writing because I was already doing it, but I sucked at it because I was 4 years old. So I was not happy. I did not think it was for me because I thought it was stupid. So I was not looking forward to the first day. So we first go in and we're brought into this really small waiting room. And to the left is a hallway that leads to a bunch of other people's offices. And then straight ahead is a hallway to the back of the building, which is like a playroom. So I get in. And after waiting a little bit, I get introduced to a mentor named Margaret. And she takes me and my mom over to her office down the left hallway. And then she starts asking Mom a couple questions. Mom starts asking Margaret a couple questions. And then she starts asking me a couple questions. And then at some point, she had Mom leave the room. This was when I was extremely uncomfortable. I did not get defiant, which is good, but I was still very uncomfortable. So Mom leaves the room, and on the inside, I'm like, help! So Margaret continues to ask a couple questions, such as, spell this, pronounce this, can you write this down? And it wasn't that long of a trial. Once we were done, I was excited that I was going to be going home because it was all over. And then Mom broke the news to me and said that I had to come back. I did not want that to come. And then I found myself a couple weeks later back into the building with Margaret, with Mom not in the room, and I still thought it was dumb. At this point, Margaret started doing something that she did consistently almost every time I saw her. She would show me an iPad, and on it would be an animated sequence. Picture you're in a classroom and you're taking any kind of test, math test, history test, whatever. You're taking a test and you need to sharpen your pencil because it just broke. But the teacher said that you can't get up. So you can't get up and sharpen your pencil, even though you had just asked the teacher. So you either have the option to get up when the teacher isn't looking and sharpen your pencil, kindly ask again if you can sharpen your pencil, or just get up and start screaming. I first had no idea what to do with these situations because they were always the same thing. It was always an animated problem. Problem comes up, and then it gives me 3 choices, and one of them's correct. I had no idea what to do with these because I had just started kindergarten. So Margaret started guiding me through them. And when I started to learn what the right answers were, I started clicking the wrong answers on purpose. I was always like, okay, it's not okay to yell. I'm gonna click the yell button, boink. And Margaret always had to tell me that that was wrong and always had to tell me why that was. And then she started doing a sort of reward system. Every time I got one of them right, she would give me access to this Batman set that was in the corner of her room. It's like a Barbie dollhouse, but it's the Batcave, basically. So I would get one right, and then let's say she gives me like the Batman action figure, and then I get another one right, and she would give me, let's say, one of Batman's gadgets, and so on. And I started to enjoy it, and I actually started to learn. And Mom started to find me speaking, reading, and writing over time. Eventually, I started seeing someone else named Ed. And he worked a little differently. So something that he did most of the time was he would turn on his computer, and he would open a Google Doc, and then he would turn on the text-to-speech setting. And then what we would do is that we would have a normal conversation with each other, and then he would see how much I was talking and how well I was talking. My little kid brain exploded when I found out that it operated by my voice. He turned it on, and I was immediately like, "Hi, my name's Aaron. How are you?" So we did that a couple times, and I started to have fun at speech therapy. Because I saw people like Ed, where we had fun on the computer. I saw people like Margaret, where I got to play with her Batman set and go through her iPad and stuff with those animated things, whatever you want to call them. And I also saw someone else named Alana, but the problem is that I saw her the least, so I don't remember what she did. But she's going to be important later, so keep her in mind. I'm not joking when I say that. So about 6 years later, I took a break from private speech therapy. And at this point, I had moved across town. My family had just met another family, and then we moved in, and now we're just one big happy family, as they call it in the Disney things. So we move in together. But in the process of moving, I had to switch schools. I went from Lolo to the other side of Missoula near the airport. So I had to go from Lolo School to Hellgate Elementary. And things got a little rough from there. Fifth grade was my first year there. And kids would immediately start going up to me. And they would find out very quickly that I had autism. And when they did, they would avoid me. They avoided me. They would lie to get away from me. And I would even get home sometimes crying because I always thought I had no friends or anything. But over time, I actually managed to find friends, and those friends even doubted me at first. So I still found friends, and everything was going okay. And then COVID came. Yeah, COVID sucked. So COVID came. For all of 6th and 7th grade, I did not see my friends as often as I could, and I was always stuck in classes with kids who always made fun of me. And the worst part was that's the key thing, is that they made fun of me. They did not just tease me. They would say they wish that I got COVID first, and that I would maybe, there were some kids who said that they wish I would even die from COVID. And it was not good. Again, I would get home crying. Thank you. I would get home crying. And the problem was that Mom could not do much because of the COVID policies. So I had to sit through this. But through it all, I never gave up. When I first moved across town, I started writing about my dreams and practice. And I was self-taught writing. I did homework, I did research, I've written like essays and everything like that at school, and I've proved that I'm really capable. Sorry, my train of thought derailed. I proved that I'm really capable. I have passed with straight A's since seventh grade, and I'm now in my junior year of high school. So ever since I got into high school, no one has doubted me. I first joined the theater department after hearing what my brother and sister always said because they did theater before me. So I did it, and everyone else was very similar. They had autism, ADHD, dyslexia, all of this stuff. So I fit in pretty well. And I was given a chance. I've had people come up to me and say, "Hey, do you want to be in this piece that I'm doing?" So I have passed with straight A's, and I've proved that I'm capable. And now I am the house and facility manager at Big Sky High School for the drama department, which is really important. So through all of this, it was a rough ride, I will say. Now ask yourself this. Is one's disability a chance to improve? Yes. It very much is. I have gone through so much, but never again will I let my disability change me in any way again.
Thanks, Aaron. Aaron wanted me to add that Ed and Alana were in the audience that night, and he ran out of time while telling his story. He wants to acknowledge them and again pass along his gratitude to them. Aaron Miller was born and raised in Missoula and currently goes to Big Sky High School. He loves dogs, performing, being outside, and making close friends. Aaron tries his best with work, people, and even himself. In the summer, he works as a camp counselor for Missoula Parks and Recreation. Aaron has had four family members before him participate in other Tell Us Something events and is proud to join the ranks of Tell Us Something storytellers. Coming up after the break.
And it's a party. Everyone's dancing. Everyone's singing along. Strangers are kissing each other, hugging. Everyone's just, hey, it's a celebration.
I realized that I was in the middle of this horrific storm, suspended from a few sheets of ripstop nylon. It's funny how there's not fear, how logic kicks in when you're making decisions that may possibly save your life.
Remember that the next Tell Us Something event is January 13th. You can learn about how to pitch your story and get tickets at tellussomething.org. Thank you to our story sponsors who help us to pay our storytellers. The Good Food Store. For more than 50 years, the Good Food Store has been Missoula's homegrown independent source for natural, organic, and locally sourced food. Learn more at goodfoodstore.com. And thanks to story sponsor Parkside Credit Union, whose mission it is to be the best place for people of Western Montana to get a loan. Learn more at parksidefcu.org. Thanks to our accessibility sponsor, SBS Solar, allowing us to provide American Sign Language interpretation at the live event. SBS Solar stands at the forefront of the solar energy revolution with over 30 years of industry experience. Specializing in custom solar design and installation for both residential and commercial applications, SBS Solar is committed to promoting energy independence and environmental sustainability. Learn more at sbslink.com. And thanks to our workshop sponsor, Wide Tide Designs, helping us to feed our storytellers at the group workshop. Wide Tide Designs is a woman-led art and design studio that produces colorful spaces and stunning artwork that fosters positivity and empowers individuals to be their best selves. Learn more at widetidedesigns.com. Thanks to our media sponsors, MissoulaEvents.net, where you find all the good things that are happening all over Missoula, and Missoula Broadcasting Company. Learn more about them and listen online at MissoulaBroadcastingCompany.com. Thanks to our in-kind sponsors, Float Missoula. Learn more at floatmsla.com. And Joyce of Tile. Learn about Joyce at joyceoftile.com. All right, let's get back to the stories. You are listening to the Tell Us Something podcast. I'm Mark Moss. Our next storyteller believes in the power of storytelling so much, he founded Tell Us Something in 2011. That's right, our next storyteller is me. I call my story, "Is anybody alive out there tonight?" Thanks for listening.
Go to your room. So I did. My 14-year-old self is stomping up the stairs, silently cursing my dad. Some perceived transgression of mine. Maybe I put the dishes in the dishwasher incorrectly. Maybe I forgot to put the vacuum cleaner away after I vacuumed the living room. I don't know. Anything could have set him off. I walked into my room and I punched play on the tape deck. Lights out tonight. Trouble in the heartland. Got a head-on collision smashing in my guts, man. Caught in a crossfire that I don't understand. But there's one thing I know for sure. I don't give a damn. For the same old played-out scenes, man, I don't give a damn. For just the in-betweens. Honey, I want the heart. I want the soul. I want control right now. You better listen to me, darling. Talk about a dream. Try to make it real. You end up in the night with a fear so real. You spend your life waiting for a moment that just don't come. Bruce Springsteen. And Bruce Springsteen got me through that moment. He got me through lots of moments in my life. He got me through my first love. The only lover I'm ever gonna need is your soft, sweet little girl's tongue. He got me through loneliness. Like a river that don't know where it's flowing, I took a wrong turn and I just kept going. And so loving somebody like that so much, somebody's music, you want to see him perform. And Bruce is a poet. He's a dreamer, but really, he's a storyteller. And he puts on 3 to 4 hour shows. And I saw him from every tour from 1988 to 2005. Not every show. But I grew up in Cleveland, so it was easier than here. And in 2005, well, first of all, the shows were amazing. And I loved him so much that in Gardner, when I lived in Gardner, Montana, I drove 11 hours. I didn't have a car, and so I was in the back of a pickup truck 11 hours to Fargo, North Dakota to go see him. You can listen to that story on the Tell Us Something website. I told it a long time ago. I even got to see him at Giant Stadium in New York City. I didn't know I was going to be in New York. This is like 2003-ish in that neighborhood. And I called my Aunt Tina, who introduced me to Bruce, and she was like, hey, don't buy a ticket. And I was like, what? Go to the scalpers. Okay, so I get on the train from Manhattan, and I go to Giant Stadium, and I walk into the parking lot, kicking rocks. I've got 20 bucks in my pocket, hoping for the best. And this guy walks up. He's like, do you need tickets? And I'm like, yeah. He goes, I go, how much are they? He goes, 30 bucks. I go, here's 10. And he's, because you need beer money. So he's like, I can't do it. I was like, okay. And I just, like, turned to start walking away. And he's like, wait a minute. I can do it. So I give him 10 bucks. This reporter walks over to me. Hey, I'm from the New York Times. I'm doing a story on scalpers. No lie, you can go to the New York Times website and read. A photographer from Missoula, Montana, Mark Moss, had this to say. That's true. But I didn't get to see the Seeger Sessions tour. So in 2005, Bruce put together this 18-piece band, brass band, and did a cover of an album of Pete Seeger songs. And Joyce got to see the show way before I knew Joyce. She was living in New Orleans right after Hurricane Katrina, and she was working at this restaurant right near the track where Jazz Fest happens. She got out of work and she just walked right in. So 2012, now we're married, she calls me at work, Mark, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band are headlining Jazz Fest this year. The Wrecking Ball album had just come out. I'm like, buy some plane tickets. We're going to New Orleans. So we go to New Orleans. We've got friends there. We're sitting at Louise's by the track, eating red beans and rice. I ask her, did you buy tickets? She goes, no. It's Jazz Fest. Don't worry about it. I'm like, look, if we don't get into this show, we might get divorced. I mean, it's important. Yeah, I was exaggerating, but I mean, really. I don't know why it didn't occur to me that like I couldn't just go buy the tickets myself, but I wasn't thinking about that. And so she sort of breaks down later, like minutes later, I don't know, an hour later, goes down, buys tickets. 20 minutes later, for the first time in history, Jazzfest sells out. So eventually, you know, Jazzfest comes around, we go to the show. It's hot, it's New Orleans, it's June, it's sweaty, it's there's no shade anywhere except for this one tree. And we're sitting under this tree, and it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and Bruce goes on at 4, and Dr. John's playing, and I'm like, let's go, we should start walking over to the stage. And Joyce is like, it's Jazz Fest. Don't worry about it. I've never been to Jazz Fest. I'm worried about it. I'm like, it's like 3:15. Can we just, I want to go see Dr. John. I've seen Dr. John, she says, but I haven't, I see. I want to see him. So it's like 3:45. I start walking over there without all my people. I don't know, whatever. They're going to do what they're going to do. They start to follow me. We get to the closest we can get, which is nowhere close. We're going to have to watch the show on Jumbotrons. We're like from here to across the street outside the dentist, and that's how far away we are. And I'm pissed. I'm grumpy. I'm frustrated. I'm trying not to let it wreck my afternoon. I'm trying to be present and get ready for the show, but it's hot outside and my hand is swelling up. And my wedding ring is stuck on my finger, and it's not like I want to take it off but my hand is hurt. My finger is hurting. It's swelling, and I'm starting to freak out, and people are offering me ice. And this woman comes running over. Don't put ice on it, she says. It's going to make it worse. She pulls lotion out of her purse, and she starts putting it on my finger, and she's rubbing my finger, and she pulls my ring off, and Bruce Springsteen walks out onto the stage. Thank God. She gives me my ring back. I put it in my pocket, and it's a party. Everyone's dancing. Everyone's singing along. Strangers are kissing each other, hugging. Everyone's just, hey, it's a celebration. And he brings us through pain and heartache and sex and rock and roll and party and just. So that year, Clarence Clemons, the saxophone player and Bruce Springsteen's best friend, had died. And Jake Clemons, Clarence's nephew, had to fill in. And during Born to Run, there's a line, the change was made uptown and the big man joined the band. And at that moment, the show stops. And a big slideshow shows up celebrating Clarence's life. He finishes the song and then he sings another song about the dead. If you're here, they're here. If you're here, they're here. If you're here, they're here. We're here together. It's like a gospel revival. So we walk out of the show, and Joyce goes, I get it. I get it now. So we drive to Portland and see him there. And we get into the show. We're close this time. We're right up near the stage. And at that moment where the change was made up time and the big man joins the band, like he stops the show again, except this time he has this long catwalk out into the audience. And he's out on the catwalk, and he turns around, and he's watching the show, you know, with us, the slideshow. And then this magical thing happens. He falls backwards off the stage into the crowd. The crowd catches him, and he's crowd surfing. I knew you were going to do that. Crowd surfing across all of us. I got to grab his ass. He gets up back up onto the stage, and he's like patting himself down, like, did somebody steal my wallet? Ha ha. And he pulls out a phone out of his pocket, and he's surprised by it. Someone had shoved their phone into his pocket. And he takes a selfie and he like throws it to the roadie. The roadie catches it and he goes, hey, if that was your phone, go get it after the show. And I'm like, you don't get that on a CD. You don't get that streaming. You don't get that on an album. You don't get that even watching a video. That's real connection. And I'm never going to get to see it again because his ticket prices are out of reach. $200 and then add the plane fare because he's not coming here. So what I'm left with is gratitude that I got to see him so many times and experience that level of connection so many times. And one of the things that he says during the show is anybody alive out there tonight? You tell me.
Thanks, me. I am the founder and director of Tell Us Something and live with my wife, Joyce, and our kitten, Ziggy, on Missoula's north side. Rounding out this episode of the Tell Us Something podcast, Karna Sunbee gets swept up in a windstorm while skydiving. Peer pressure and borrowed gear led to a harrowing experience in a story that she calls My Last Jump. Thanks for listening.
There I was, hanging 1,200 feet above the earth in gale force winds, and this is no shit. And that, my friends, is how a good skydiving story begins. It's true, I was dangling from a parachute in the middle of a storm, being swept up the valley towards Snowball Ski Area. The next day's Missoulian front page would read, 59-mile-an-hour winds wallop western Montana. Skydiver lost up Grant Creek. It was August 15th, 1988, and what a great day it had been. It was a reunion of the Silvertip Skydivers, which was a club at the University of Montana in the 60s and 70s. The party was happening at Grant Creek in a meadow equipped with barbecues, kegs, and a Cessna 180 that was taking off and landing all day to give these old skydivers the chance for another free fall together. Although I had made well over 300 jumps with this club, I had no intention of making a skydive today. It had been 10 years, and I had never flown one of these fancy square parachutes that everyone was now using. And the ripcord wasn't here anymore. It was down here someplace. And the reserve parachute that you'd used in case of a malfunction wasn't here where you could see it. It was behind you someplace. So no, everything was so different, and I was not going to jump. And then my friend started saying, come on, it's going to be so much fun. Come on, the sunset's going to be so pretty from up there. So with that little bit of peer pressure, I changed my mind and was soon donning borrowed gear. I was wearing somebody else's jumpsuit that was too big, somebody else's rig that wasn't comfortable, somebody else's soft leather helmet, unlike the hard motorcycle-type helmet that I was accustomed to. My own gear I had given away 10 years earlier, and I loved it. Every time I looked up at that and saw that beautiful white and blue parachute, I felt like I was with an old friend who had safely landed me in so many different drop zones. We had jumped into the Oval at the university, into fireworks stands over the 4th of July, into weddings and rodeos and football games. I loved it. But this gear was so unfamiliar, and it had been so long, that I said to the three guys I was with on this jump, today I'm going to dump high, which meant I'm going to pull my ripcord earlier than you pull yours, maybe 1,000 feet earlier, so that I have a longer parachute ride, so that in the unlikely event that I have a malfunction, I have more time to deal with it. So we were climbing into the plane, and my buddy Andy ran up with a hard helmet and said, wear this instead, it'll be safer. So I swapped the soft leather one off my head for the harder, safer helmet, and little did I know how grateful I would later be for this kind gesture. We took off, and the plan was to go up to 8,000 feet for a 30-second free fall. But at 5,000 feet, the tower from the Missoula airport called us and said, if you're going to go, you better go right now. There's a big storm rolling in. So we looked out the open door of the airplane, and we could see these huge black clouds on the horizon. So we jumped. It was incredible to be in free fall again. I had forgotten how much I loved this. And we were doing relative work, which meant we were flying together, holding hands, making a circle that was falling through the sky. Epic. Our parachutes all opened successfully, and I was having so much fun flying this smaller, faster chute called a paraplane. I took the goggles off my eyes and clicked them on top of my helmet so I could feel the breeze in my face. I looked down and I could see the other three guys lower than me getting ready to make perfect landings in the meadow. And my approach was all set up. I was going to have a great landing as well. When suddenly I was moving backwards. Now, this parachute had 32 miles an hour forward speed, and I was being blown backwards. And then suddenly I was being buffeted around by this heavy, heavy winds. I looked down at the ground. I looked at my altimeter and saw I had gone up a couple hundred feet, which just doesn't happen with this kind of parachute. I realized that I was in the middle of this horrific storm, suspended from a few sheets of ripstop nylon. It's funny how there's not fear, how logic kicks in when you're making decisions that may possibly save your life. My first thought was maybe I'm caught in winds aloft, so I cranked a toggle, a steering line, hard to make the parachute spiral down fast to get out of such winds. But no, I was still being blown backwards. So my second thought was, where can I possibly land? In those days, at the base of Grant Creek, there were just a few neighborhoods, and then it was forest all the way up to Snowball. So I looked over my shoulder, and in the forest, I could see three homes with pretty big yards. And I thought, well, maybe I'll land in one of those yards. And then I thought, no, they're probably surrounded by electrical wires. I've never flown this parachute. It's just too dangerous. So way up there, I had seen a clearing closer to Snowball. And I decided to turn and run with the wind and see if I could make it to the clearing. Now, you know that my parachute had 32 miles an hour forward speed. And you know that the winds had been clocked at 59 miles an hour. So you can do the math. I was screaming up that valley. I didn't make it to the clearing. About 25 feet above treetop level, I turned back into the wind because it would be better to land going 30 miles an hour backwards than to downwind it forward at 90 miles an hour. Fortunately, I remembered the tree landing protocol I had learned when I trained with the Silvertip Skydivers back in 1970. You cross your legs like this and your arms like this because one of the many bad outcomes of this situation was that I could land on top of a dead lodgepole pine, skewered through some vulnerable body part, and bleed to death. But no, I was crashing through the lodgepole pines. Branches, debris, twigs going everywhere. And I remember thinking, damn, I wish I was still wearing my goggles. I thundered in and landed hard on the ground, feet, butt, head, hard enough to crack my pelvis. And without that helmet, I wonder if I would have cracked my skull. The wind was so intense that my parachute was still inflated and it was dragging me through the trees. And I reached up and started pulling the harness down. And then the harness is connected to the parachute by shroud lines, and I'm pulling the shroud lines down, trying to collapse the parachute. Finally, I got it deflated and I scooted back and laid on top of it so it wouldn't reinflate. Eventually, the wind subsided. I tried to stand up, and that's when I knew my leg was broken. So there's nothing I could do but wait. As dusk approached, trying not to think of lions and wolves and bears, oh my! And with a little prayer in my heart that went something like, God, if you get me out of this one, I promise never again. Meanwhile, back at the party, that storm hit hard and fast, and shit was being blown all over the place. And my friends saw me being blown away. So they jumped into their vehicles and raced up the road to rescue me. Now, in one of those three homes I had seen from the air, a family was gathered out on their front porch watching this spectacular storm, and they saw me fly by. And then a little bit later, they saw my friends drive by. So they started shouting, "He went that way!" Lucky me, at least they would be looking on the correct side of the road. It was probably over an hour before they found me, and all I can say is thank God for shock. And when they did find me, they showed me this big branch that I had apparently broken off a tree, which had apparently broken my leg. I call it a limb for a limb situation. They firemen carried me out of the forest and drove me to the emergency room at St. Pat's Hospital. And I didn't know if the medical insurance I had at my job would cover a skydiving injury. So I told them that I'd been playing Frisbee. And ran into a bench. I also didn't know that search and rescue had been called out to locate me. So you can imagine my surprise when this burly sheriff's deputy comes walking into the exam room. "So, broke your leg," she said. "Mm-hmm," I nodded. "And you were up Grant Creek, were you?" "Mm-hmm," I said. "And you were playing Frisbee, were you?" "Mm-hmm." "And you ran into a bench, did you?" "Mm-hmm." "Low-flying bench," she asked. "And that's no shit."
Thanks, Karna. Karna Sundby has always been on her own unique, uncharted path. Her curiosity and spiritual quest has taken her to places that most people would find bizarre, wondrous, or enlightening, depending on their personal life experience. The one word they would never use to describe Karna is boring. Karna's gift and curse is being fearless. Thanks for listening to the Tell Us Something podcast. Remember that the next Tell Us Something event is January 13th. The theme is Hold My Beer. Learn how to pitch your story and get tickets at tellussomething.org. Tune in next week to hear the concluding stories from the Never Again live storytelling event.
I distinctly thought about the dollhouse in the corner, the horse mural on the wall. And so when I started to wake up from that nighttime nap, I was really surprised to look around and see thorn branches instead of that childhood bedroom wall.
The meadows are there. They're up to our knees in color and riotous glory. It's a misty day, so we aren't hot. It's cool. And the mist has made the flowers scream at us. It's glorious. And I'm hiking with my daughter.
Thank goodness for the open mouthpiece, right? Yeah. So I'm throwing up everywhere. And all of a sudden, the crowd of kids just falls completely silent. And a kid goes, "Hey, that's my grandma's costume that you're throwing up in."
Listen for those stories at tellussomething.org or wherever you get your podcasts.